book of Revelation. Why are you having us turn to Daniel chapter 2? A couple of reasons. The book of Revelation is the last book in the Bible. And it's fitting that it should be the last book in the Bible because it comes after all the other books in the Bible. That's profound thinking on my part, but the point I'm trying to make is that before you get to the last chapter of a book, usually you read all the other chapters first, right? Well, unless it's a mystery or something like that, then you flip to the end. And a lot of people do that with the Bible. I just want to know how what happens in the end. You know, you flip to the book of Revelation and you get the answer. The problem is that in the book of Revelation, there's over 300 references to Old Testament stuff. And so to really get a grip on the last book of the Bible, it's really good to have an understanding and a working knowledge of the rest of the Bible. And so, having said that, one of the areas that needs to be understood and well nailed down to have a proper understanding of Revelation is Daniel's prophecies. In fact, Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7 and chapter 9 specifically are what I would call the vertebrae to the backbone of Bible prophecy. Chapter 2 and chapter 7 and chapter 9 of the book of Daniel make up the backbone, if you would, of understanding Bible prophecy. And I thought it would be good for this morning and maybe even next week on our Sunday morning services to pause for a minute and to just take a couple steps backwards and, for some of you, shore up a foundation that's already there, and for some of you, pour a foundation. And that is to go back and get some basic understandings of Bible prophecy, because we're at the point in our study of the book of Revelation that if you're unclear on some of these things that Daniel had to say back in the day, you'll be unclear all the way through to the end. You need to have a proper understanding and a well thought through working knowledge of Daniel's prophecies, Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 9 to be specific. So this morning, we're going to try to, again, erect the skeleton so that as we go through Revelation, we can kind of hang the meat on it, so to speak. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle, you know? I was telling First Service, I wish God would have just had the book of prophecy in the Bible. You know, just one book called the book of prophecy. And you just open to the book of prophecy and it tells you everything you need to know, you know, in order, how everything's going to play out. And that would make things really simple, wouldn't it? But God, in his ultimate awesome wisdom and knowledge and all the rest, he peppers prophecies throughout the whole Bible. And it can kind of be like a jigsaw putting them together. You look at pieces and you go, well, how does that fit with, you know, that piece? And how does that piece fit with that piece? And so what do you do when you start to put together a jigsaw puzzle? You dump it out on your coffee table and you look at it and you go, oh my goodness, this is a mess. What am I doing? So what's the first thing you do? You get all the corners. You find the corners. You put them in place. You get the flat edges and you create the frame and then you fill it in. And that's kind of what my heart is with this Daniel study, is to, if you would, put the corners in place. If you would, put the edges on so that as we go through Revelation, we're filling in the rest of the picture. But you understand, it's hard to do if you don't understand the perimeters and the boundaries and the way things are supposed to go. So my heart and desire this morning is to begin to kind of look at this, a couple of these prophecies, so that as we go through Revelation, we can have a proper and a better understanding of the way that prophecy is understood. And so the great thing is that God's not a God of confusion. You know, people think prophecy is way too hard to understand or comprehend, but I don't necessarily agree, especially in the day and age that we live in, where most of prophecy is history. And there's only a small percentage that hasn't happened yet. And so let's take a look at this, starting in Daniel 2. And we're going to depart this morning a little bit from our Sunday morning style of having church. And this will be more of a Thursday night style, in that we're going to kind of tackle the whole chapter verse by verse and kind of take a look at it. Now, having said all that, it would be really good for you to consider coming on Thursday nights. And if you can't make Thursday nights, perhaps getting the CD or downloading the message from the internet, because the Thursday nights are when we're going verse by verse through the book of Revelation, and you won't be able to get all of it in context unless you're tracking with that study. So, but again, this morning we're going to kind of put the corners of the jigsaw puzzle in place, if you would, starting in Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, follow along. I'm going to read kind of in some big chunks here. Follow along. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show him his dreams. So they came and they stood before the king. Now Nebuchadnezzar, just as a point of background, so you know what's going on. Remember, in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar and his army stormed into Israel and they basically took over. And with them, they went in, they took away a whole huge group of the Jews and led them back into captivity into Babylon. And among that contingency was none other than Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you can read about that in chapter 1 of Daniel. And so Nebuchadnezzar is on the throne. And keep in mind, Nebuchadnezzar at this point, and really probably for all practical purposes, probably the most powerful man that was ever in charge on the planet Earth. The man was an absolute dictator. It was a pure dictatorship. You didn't question his word. He ruled over the known world, really, at that time. And if he said jump, you said how high. And if he said dead, you're dead. And if he said you live, you live. And whatever he said goes. It was a pure dictatorship. And Nebuchadnezzar was the man. And Nebuchadnezzar, this king of the world, it says in the second year of his reign there that he had dreams. And the dreams troubled him so much that it broke him out of his sleep. You ever been ripped out of your sleep? Man, last night, I got home from family camp and I was tired. I don't know about any of you, but I slept on the ground for the most part of family camp. And I was just beat last night when I got home. And so I plopped down on the couch and I was watching cartoon with my kids or something. Next thing I know, I'm out. My wife had covered me up and set up the coffees and the alarm clock so I could get up early, and she just left me there. I was out. But when I'm woken up out of my sleep in a hurry, I'm not in the spirit necessarily. I awake rather abruptly and I'm not, you know, real coherent. And she let the dog in and all of a sudden I'm just hitting something. And what I realized is that my dog came up to say hi and it rubbed his little cute little wet nose on my arm and I just bashed him in the face. And I was getting up to rear up and hit him again and I woke up and I'm like, whoa, what am I doing? You know, Pacha, come here, I'm sorry, buddy. And you know, he forgave me and we're all good now. And he studied with me this morning in my study and stuff. So we're on good terms now. Don't turn me into the dog police or whatever. I wasn't aware of what I was doing at the time. But man, I don't react well when I'm ripped out of my sleep. Have you ever had a dream that you wake up and you go, wow, that was a weird dream? Somebody says, well, tell me about it. Well, I can't really remember it. You ever had a dream like that? You can't remember it, but you know it was kind of weird and it kind of troubled you throughout the day or whatever. Well, Nebi, he has this dream and it really rocks him, completely ruins his day, and he just can't quite remember what it was, but he knew it was important, and so he's freaking out. And verse 3 says, the king said to them, after he calls all his quote-unquote wise men, astrologers and such, together, he said, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. And then spake the Chaldeans to the king of Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. And the king said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. And if you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation of thereof, you'll be cut into little pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. Nebuchadnezzar had a way with words, and he was a very mild, even-tempered guy. He says, you better tell me the dream and what it meant, or else I'm going to cut you up into pieces and I'm going to make your house a dunghill. I'm not sure what that means, but it doesn't sound good. And he says, but if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. And they answered again and said, let the king tell his servant the dream and we will show you the interpretation thereof. And the king answered and said, I know of certainty that you would gain the time because you see that the thing is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me until the times be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. He says, I'm not going to tell you the dream, because I can tell that you know I forgot it. So if I tell you the dream, all I know is that you're going to lie to me and tell me what you think I want to hear. He says, no, I'm not playing that game. You tell me what the dream was, and then I'll know that you're qualified to tell me what it meant. You guys tracking with the story so far? Well, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there's not a man upon the face of the earth who can show the king this matter. Therefore, there is no king, nor lord, nor ruler that has ever asked such a thing of any magician or astrologer of Chaldean. They say, hey, give us a break. You're asking us to do what nobody's ever asked anybody to do. And this is a rare thing that the king requires. And there is none other that can show up before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. For this cause the king was angry and very furious. Very furious, I think, is redundant. He was very angry, is the point. And he commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth, and the wise men, that they should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellow servants to be slain. Oh, so Nebi flips his noodle right here and just gets crazy and says, if you can't tell me the dream, that's it. Kill them all. Kill all the wise men. Kill all the astrologers. Kill all the... just, if you guys are worth nothing. He was a little hasty. And so it says that they sent to find Daniel because they knew Daniel and his guys, that they were among the wise men. And so they were going to get whacked too. So verse 14 says, Daniel answered with the counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which had gone forth to slay the men of Babylon. So Nebi sent out Arioch, who was the guy who had to do all the dirty work. He was the guy who had to round up all the guys and kill them. And Daniel finds him, they find Daniel, and Daniel said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so hasty? Arioch made the king the thing known to Daniel. So Arioch told Daniel what was going on. Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he should show the king, that he would show the king the interpretation. I like that. He says, hold the phone. Give me some time. And we'll tell the king the interpretation of his dream. Just buy me some time. Give me some time. I like that. Daniel's a man of faith. And then it says, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. By the way, that's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, his companions, that they should desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning the secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. I love this. This is so funny to me. Daniel says, hey, wait a minute. Whoa. Chill out. That's what it means in the Hebrew. Chill out. He says, go tell the king. Give me some time. I'll make known the interpretation. It'll be fine. So Arioch goes his way, and I can just see Daniel running back to the house. Guys, we got to have a prayer meeting right now. I just told the king that I could tell him what's going on. And so he didn't know, so he grabs his guys, and I imagine they had a pretty good prayer meeting that night. Lord, I just told the king that I could show the interpretation. I was wondering, could you kind of share that with me? And so I could, and it doesn't say that it happened, but I would imagine that they had a pretty intense prayer meeting that night. But I like this next verse in verse 19. Then the secret was revealed unto Daniel when? In a night vision. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. I like that. I assume, and I'm maybe speculating here a little bit, that Daniel and his boys had a very intense prayer meeting. God, come on, show us, reveal to us what's going on. But when was it revealed to Daniel? In a night vision. When? When he was sleeping. When he was resting. You know, I have found that there's times where I'm wrestling with stuff and praying to the Lord about things and intensely seeking God on things that I need to know and I need to find, whether it's direction in my life or a problem or a situation or whatever. And I have found more often than not that the answer is always revealed to me, not when I'm struggling and straining, but when I'm just resting in the Lord. When I just pray and I give it to Him and I allow His peace to just flood my heart and mind. And then when I'm just at rest, you know, that's when the Lord oftentimes meets me in my situation. And that's what happened to Daniel. So he worships God. Now check this out. Daniel just kind of blesses God, and I like this. He said, blessed be the name, or praise the name of God forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the season. He removes kings and he sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to them that have understanding. He revealeth the deep and the secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou my God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and has made known unto me that what was desired of you, that you might, that thou hast made known unto the king's matter. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captains of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. I like this. Daniel shows up at the palace. Arioch, the Lord spoke to me. I've got the interpretation. Bring me in. Bring me in to the king. So Arioch, the king's faithful servant, comes in and says, O King Nebuchadnezzar, I found a guy. I found him. I looked hard, and I'm the one. I found him. I sought him out. I like that. Arioch kind of like, he takes a little credit there. I just think that's kind of funny. So Daniel comes in before the king. And the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? And listen to Daniel's response. I like this. Daniel answered in the presence of the king. Now keep in mind, Daniel answered in the presence of the king. You didn't just come and, you know, it'd be like, you don't just say, you know, I think I'll go see George today. You don't just roll into the White House and knock on the front door. Hey, come on. You know, you probably wouldn't make it to go see George in the Oval Office. You'd be stopped by security guys and probably shot on scene or whatever. But, you know, why? Because George W. is the president. You know, he's one of the most powerful men in the world. You know, he has nothing on Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a dictator, and he was the king of the known world at that time. And so just imagine standing before George W. I mean, that even if you're not a Republican or not, you know, didn't vote or whatever, don't like George, that's not what I'm talking about. Any president, it would be an honor. It would be a little bit nerve-wracking to stand before any president because, whoa, you know, it's not just him. It's his whole entourage and the Secret Service and everybody. You'd be like, this. It would be kind of an intimidating thing. Well, here's Daniel standing before the king of the world, who's at his very word could have Daniel and his whole family or friends killed in a second. And Daniel's standing there before the king, and he says, let me hear it, Daniel. And Daniel says, I love this. He takes a minute and pauses and said, there's a God in heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and thy visions upon thy head are these. I like that. He could have just said, yeah, Nebi, I'm your man. I got your info. I got the 411, what you need right here. I got it right here. He stops like Kurt Warner in the 1999 Super Bowl victory over the Titans. Remember that? When Kurt Warner, the MVP for the Rams, when they won the Super Bowl in 99, at the end of the game, and the crowd's going bananas, and they shove a mic in his face, and they said, well, what do you have to say? You know, what do you think? You know, you're the MVP. You brought the Rams to victory. It's a Cinderella story. And he goes, first things first, I want to give all credit and glory to Jesus Christ. And I love that, man. I don't remember the exact words he said, but I like that. He had the opportunity to say in front of the world, yeah, you know, I did it. It was pretty good, you know. It was my skill and my passing, and, you know, and yeah, the rest of the team, they helped out or whatever. But man, he stopped, and I like that he said, first things first. I like that. Not to put, you know, Kurt too high on a pedestal or anything, but I just like that. Here's Daniel, and he says, first things first, Nebi. Before I tell you the dream, you need to understand it's not me. It's God. And I say that because, you know, God uses people that get that. I think God uses people who understand that principle, that it's really not us. Anything good that comes through us, it's the Lord. And I, you know, I get real nervous when people start taking God's credit or telling why God's blessed their ministry or why God, and they can formulate it somehow and say, well, God blesses me because I tithe or I do this or I do that. I go, ooh, wait a minute. God blesses you and uses us because he's God and he's merciful and gracious. And I like that. Daniel didn't even for a second try to rob any of God's glory or credit. But I do want you to notice verse 29, what he says. It's interesting. He says, he has revealed secrets and made known unto you what shall come to pass. It's a futuristic dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. It has to do with the future. Listen, look at verse 30 again. Daniel's humility. As for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any other living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts on thy heart. Thou, O king, saw and behold a great image. This great image whose brightness excellent stood before thee, and the form of it was terrible. Now, in verse 29 it says, he says, as for you, O king, your thoughts came upon your mind in your bed. So evidently, Nebuchadnezzar was laying in bed, pondering, wondering about the future. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to my kingdom? What's going to happen to me? What's this all about? And so he has this dream that's dealing with just that, the future. So Daniel's about to lay it out. But I just like this. Have you ever laid in bed like that, staring up at the ceiling, and it's late and everybody else is asleep, and you're wondering, what's going to happen in my situation? Lord, what am I supposed to do? Lord, how's this going to work out? He laid there and he pondered and he dreamed about it, but you know, God had an answer all along. And he gives the answer really to Nebuchadnezzar, and he doesn't even really understand it. So Daniel comes in and explains it. But I just like that because it always assures me. You know, there are times when I lay in bed, Lord, what's going to happen? How's this going to play out? What's my future hold? What's going to happen with my kids? Are they going to be okay? And you know, I just want to remind you, the Lord knows, and he's got it all in control. And just like the psalmist, we can rest and have sleep because, you know, the Lord is in control. Amen? Don't worry. Trust the Lord. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, verse 32, it says, or verse 31, he says, O king, Daniel says to Nebi, you beheld a great image. So first part is this. This dream that has to do with the future was an image. Okay, now what is this image? It said it stood before you, and the form of it was terrible. That means it was awesome, awe-inspiring, huge. And it says the image's head was of fine gold, and the breast and his arms were of silver, and his belly and his thighs were of brass, and his legs, his feet, part iron. Pardon me, his legs were of iron, and his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest until a stone which was cut without hands, which smote the image upon its feet that were of iron and of clay, and brake them into pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken into pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now, what in the world is this dream about? Let's pray and we'll find out next week. No, I'm just kidding. This dream, Nebuchadnezzar dreams and he has this vision of a man, a statue, an image. It's massive, evidently. It's huge, terrible, awesome. And as he looks at that image, evidently the head was made out of what? Gold. And the arms and the chest were made out of silver. And the stomach and the thighs were made out of brass. And the legs were made out of iron. And the toes were made out of iron and clay. And then he sees a little stone that comes rolling down the hill. And it's a stone that's not cut with man's hand. In other words, it hadn't been carved or touched. It's just the stone comes rolling and boom, hits the statue. But where does it hit it? In the feet, at the 10 toes. And boom, destroys this statue, this image, so completely that it's ground to dust and just blows away like chaff in the wind. Then it says that little stone becomes a mountain, becomes huge. Now, what in the world does this mean? Well, we don't have to guess, because not only does Daniel... Now, by the way, when I get to heaven, I always say I'm going to rent certain DVDs so I can kind of watch these scenes. I'm going to get this one for sure, because don't you want to see the look on Nebuchadnezzar's face when Daniel says, okay, Nebi, what you dreamed was there was this great image, and I bet he just went, you know, jaw hit the floor. Yeah, yeah, go on, tell me more. I bet there was just silence in there, all eyes on Daniel. We don't have to guess the interpretation because he makes it real clear. Listen to this. The dream, this is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for God of heaven has given you a kingdom of power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand. And he has made you ruler of them all. He says, you're a king of kings. You're a mighty king. He says, anybody who's alive, you're basically the king of the world. And even the animals and everything, you kind of are overseeing. You're it, Nebi. And he says, you are this head of gold. Interesting. Let's pause here for a second. He says, Nebuchadnezzar, that image that you saw, which went from gold to silver to brass to iron mixed with clay. Let's start at the top, Nebuchadnezzar. You're a king. You're a king of kings. You have an awesome kingdom. And you are that head of gold. What is he saying? Now, did you notice, by the way, that the image, this statue or whatever it was of a man, it started with the head of gold, which is a pure, very valuable metal, right? But the next metal is what? Silver, the next one is brass, and the next one is iron, and the next one is iron mixed with clay. It goes down in value and in strength as you get further down. Not necessarily in strength, but it goes down in value. Does that make sense? Gold is precious. Silver is precious too, but it's not as precious as you know, as gold. And brass is semi-precious, I guess, but it's not near as precious as silver, which is not near as precious as gold. And then iron is, you know, it's iron. And then iron and clay, it's iron and dirt, you know. So it's like it went from gold down to iron mixed with clay. And he says, basically, Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold. What Daniel was saying in that is this: you are represented by that head of gold. And what we're going to see as we go through this image is that this image represents Gentile world powers in succession until the coming of Jesus Christ, which is the rock that destroys, as we'll see in a minute. Now, you might be a little fuzzy on that, but it'll become more clear. But I want to just get your mind thinking in the right direction. Daniel's assigning those metals to different kingdoms. Now, the kingdom, the gold head represented the Babylonian kingdom, which was a golden, pure dictatorship. He said, Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold. And you've got an, by the way, that's why in Daniel chapter 3, as an act of defiance, Nebuchadnezzar makes a huge statue completely made of gold. In other words, he's saying, nobody's coming after me. My kingdom will stand forever. I'm Nebuchadnezzar. You know, that, just interesting fact for you there. But then he says this, verse 39, after you shall arise another kingdom that's inferior to you. Now, what happened after the Babylonian kingdom fell? Did another world Gentile, that is a non-Jewish world power, come on the scene? Yes, who? The Medo-Persians, the Persian Empire, correct? It's really the Medo-Persian, but we refer to it a lot of times as the Persian Empire. And it wasn't as pure or as strong as a kingdom as the gold Babylonian kingdom. For instance, Nebuchadnezzar, when he said jump, you said how high. If he said you're going to die, you're dead. If he said anything, it was law. But the Medo-Persian wasn't quite as strong or as pure as a kingdom. Remember even Daniel, after he was thrown in the lion's den, after Nebuchadnezzar was off the scene and the Medo-Persians were in control. Remember when Daniel was thrown in the lion's den and King Darius couldn't change the law because it had been written down and there was a decree. All that to say is if it was Nebuchadnezzar, he would have said, well, just pull him out. But he couldn't, because There was the laws of the land. It wasn't as strong as of a dictatorship or as pure as a rule as are you tracking with me? As the Babylonian Empire. So the Babylonians came. The Medo Persians, two arms, came, and they were made out of silver. And then another kingdom of brass shall arise and rule over the earth. Now, who came and conquered the Medo-Persian Empire? Who was the next world-conquering Gentile power? Greece, correct. Led by who? The Great. Remember the Alexander the Grape candies that you could, like lemon heads, but they were grape? Anyway. Alexander the Great came in, and he conquered really the known world at that time with unparalleled swiftness and speed. I think he was 33 years old when he cried out and was bummed because he said, there's no more worlds to conquer. Oh, you poor thing, you know. What a tough life, you know. You've conquered the world at 33, you poor thing. You know, there's nothing left for you to do. Alexander the Great. And then after Alexander the Great, now check this out. Now, this is where it gets really important and you need to really focus in. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. Now, after the Babylonians came the Medo-Persians, and then after that came Greece. And then after Greece, Greece was conquered and taken over by who? Rome. Rome. The Roman Empire is represented by the iron legs. And if you know anything about world history, and I'm not a huge world history guy, I like it. I know enough to know that when Rome came on the scene, they beat and bloodied and bruised everybody into submission. Rome came in and conquered, and if you didn't submit, you were beaten down and bloodied and taken captive. Man, Rome came in with an iron club, with iron legs, just trampling over the known world and taking it over. And so Rome is represented by iron, by the iron legs. So you have an interesting thing here. You have the Gentile ruling nations, Gentile again being non-Jewish. You have the starting in the 600s BC, you have Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greece, and then Rome. Rome came in. But then Rome fell. But there's another kingdom that's mentioned here. Notice this. A separate kingdom, separate from the iron kingdom, the Roman kingdom, but having to do with the Roman kingdom. Because it has the base of iron, but it's mixed with clay. So it reminds us of the Roman kingdom. It has something to do with that Roman imperial kingdom, but it's different in the sense that it's mixed with clay. Notice verse 41. Whereas thou sawest the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of the iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in the strength of the iron, there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And the toes of the feet, part iron and part clay. So the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken, that is, brittle. Whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now, this is interesting. We just follow the pattern of what's being said here. What is this whole vision about? It's about Gentile, that is non-Jewish, world powers, starting with Nebuchadnezzar in succession, right? We've seen that. We don't have to guess. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. The Medo-Persians came in. Greece came in after that. Rome came in after that. But pray tell, who is this ten-toe, part clay, part iron kingdom? Who do they represent? Who are they? Well, who came next in history? Whoa, you got to pause there and stop, because here's the thing that you need to understand. Look at the next verse. In the days of these kings, what kings? Each toe represents a king or a kingdom or a country. We know that, by the way, from the parallel vision in Daniel 7, where it's not 10 toes, but it's 10 horns. And each horn is representative of a different country or a different kingdom. Okay? Check this out. In the days of these kings, what kings? The 10 toes kings. Shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it will stand forever. Did you catch that? Remember the dream? What happened in the dream? A rock came down and hit where? The 10 toes. And blew apart the whole thing. And then that king, the whole man's governing system, him governing himself, was done away with. And all of a sudden, this little rock became this huge mountain, can consume the earth. Who is that rock? What is that rock? It's Jesus Christ, the rock of our salvation. Now check this out. In verse 44, it says, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. In other words, in the days when these 10 kings who are united, part clay, part iron, when they're set up and when they're ruling and they're doing their thing, that's when Jesus is coming back. So the question becomes, who is this 10 nation confederation made out of clay but has the roots of iron in it? I suggest to you that it is a kingdom that hasn't quite formed or happened yet. That has its roots in iron, that is, in Rome, in the old Roman Empire. It's what we call the revived Roman Empire. Now stop. We got to time out for a second. And hopefully I'm not losing any of you. Time out for a second. You might say, well, wait a minute, Jason. What about after Rome? You're saying that it jumps from Rome all the way to a futuristic revived Roman Empire? What about all the kingdoms after Rome? What about Charlemagne? What about Hitler? What about all these guys and stuff? What about all these kingdoms that happened after Rome? How come the Bible doesn't mention them? Now, whatever you do, get this. Understand this. Because if you miss this point that I'm about to make, you will not understand how to look at Bible prophecy. It's not that big of a secret, but it's really important. All of Bible prophecy revolves around Israel. All of Bible prophecy revolves around what's happening in the nation of Israel. It revolves around the Jews. Now you say, well, what does that have to do with anything? Think about it. Who was ruling over the Jews in the Babylonian Empire? The Babylonians. And when they were done away with, Israel was still there, but who oversaw the Jews during that period of time? The Medo-Persians. After the Medo-Persians came in, Greece, Alexander the Great, stormed in. Was Israel under the control of Greece? Yes. Now, it's interesting that Alexander didn't destroy Jerusalem. And that's a really interesting story sometime if we can get into that. But Alexander the Great and Greece had relations with, and they were overseeing, and they had power over Israel. Did Rome have power over Israel? Yes. In fact, in the days that Jesus was living, why do you think that, you know, they were so hungry for Messiah to come? They wanted Jesus to come, the Messiah. Why? To throw off the Roman oppressors. Why? Because Rome was, they were set up in Israel, and they were ruling the world, the known world at that time, including Israel. So all these Gentile world powers that we looked at, Babylon, the Medo-Persians, Greece, Rome, they all were intertwined with and had something to do with Israel. So you say, now wait a minute, Jason, now why are you skipping way ahead to a futuristic conglomeration or a group of kings bound together that hasn't happened yet? What about all the other groups? Because what happened by Rome, through Rome, in AD 70? Israel was completely destroyed. Israel was wiped out. So if you would, if you're tracking with me, if Israel is the timepiece, if Israel is how we track the timeline for Bible prophecy, all of a sudden Israel is no more. Israel was cut off. Israel was wiped out in AD 70. So what happens? Click, if you would, the time, the stopwatch stops. Stop. Why? Because there's no Israel. There's no Jewish homeland. Do you guys understand? Because here's the thing. We don't get this as much as maybe our grandparents get this. There was no Israel for hundreds and hundreds and thousands even of years, almost thousands. Do you realize that in AD 70, when Jesus predicted, he said, hey, you see, they said, look at the temple. He said, there won't be one stone left upon another. They're going to come. And what did Rome do in AD 70? They came in, they knocked down every stone, which don't think of little stones. These stones are like 100 feet by 40 feet. They're huge. Knocking these things over, destroying, changing the whole name of the land to Palestine, completely wiping the Jew off the face of the earth, seemingly. But what happened? Miracle of miracles. The Jews retained their ethnicity. They retained their identity, which is a miraculous thing, because history tells us that when a country is taken over by another country, it only takes two generations. We're not talking hundreds of years. Two generations for the people of that country to completely assimilate into the rest of the world. In other words, they lose their cultural identity. They're just wiped out. They're just like the Philistines. How many Philistines do you know? Anybody know? No, because they're an extinct people. There are no Philistines around. But the Jews, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, held on to their ethnic purity. And on May 14th, 1948, right after World War II, right when the world for a moment had sympathy for the Jews because of all the millions of Jews that were murdered in Auschwitz and in all the other concentration camps, the world for a moment had sympathy on the Jewish people. And there was this movement in the early 1900s, in the 20s, this Zionist movement, it's been called. Maybe you're wondering what that means. When what they call Zionist Jews were from all over the world, from Germany and from, you know, the United States and from everywhere, were just migrating back to Israel, what was at one time Israel, which was then known as Palestine. They were going back to Palestine. Why? Because they wanted their own homeland. And on May 14th, 1948, the UN, boom, in one day, okayed them to have their own homeland, which is a lot bigger, even if you want to go by the 1948 standards, should be a lot bigger than what they have right now. But the point is this. All of a sudden, in one day, a nation was born. The prophet Isaiah says, can a nation be born in a day? The answer is yes. The Bible predicted it. The Bible predicted it. The Bible predicted it. Guys, it's a miracle. We read about Israel every day in the news. But do you realize our grandparents, great-grandparents, whatever, there was no Israel. And not until 1948. So again, now if Israel is the timepiece by which you gauge Bible prophecy, that should tell us that. Now, Jason, are you saying that if Israel came back into play, if they came back to become a nation again, does that mean in 1948 they should maybe start looking for that 10-toe thing? Yeah. In 1948, Europe began to unite. And what they called the Benelux countries, Luxembourg and a bunch of other countries started to come together and say, we need to bind together as a united Europe, a revived Roman Empire, if you would. And some of the countries began to bind together. In fact, in 1951, the ECSC was established. That's the European Coal and Steel Workers Cooperation or Confederation or whatever it was called, was formed, where they began to get their industry crossing borders, and more countries came aboard. And then in 1957, the EEC was founded, which is the European Economic Community, where they began to try to work towards a one economic system in Europe. And then in 1967, I think it is, the EFTA was founded, which is the European Free Trade Association. And then in 1960, all those guys, the financial end, the industrial side, all these guys in different countries coming in at that point, which I don't have the list in front of me, but they started coming together. And then in 1960, it was all merged together, and it was called the European Community. And then in 1993, they had another treaty and they brought it all together. And now it was just called the European Union. Then in 1991, the euro was introduced. And then in January 1st, 2002, the euro was implemented. And now we have in Europe the beginnings of a United States of Europe, if you would. Now, you're saying, now, wait a minute, Jason. Are you saying that what we see happening in Israel, or pardon me, in Europe, is what these 10 toes are? And I would say yes. Now, I'm not saying that the European Union as it is right now is the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2 or the 10 horns of Daniel chapter 7. But what I'm saying is, undoubtedly, beyond the shadow of a doubt, you are witnessing along with me the revival of the old Roman Empire in Europe. And I guarantee, because of the Bible, that the power base of that will eventually shift to Rome. And so it's in Belgium now. And you see, I forget how many members there are in the EU. Maybe you could help me out. I think there's 15, and I think 12 are using the euro, which is a currency that has united Europe in that way. All I'm trying to point towards is this, and I'm not trying to freak you out or make any outlandish predictions or... more Gentile world power when Israel is reestablished that will rule, and that 10-toed world dominating power will be iron, in that it will have its roots in the old iron, that is the old Roman Empire, but it will be partly clay, in that it won't be stable. Why? Because it'll be a union of treaties and diplomatic attempts at trying to pull this thing together, and it's not going to be strong. It's going to be brittle. It's not going to work right. It's not going to be like the old Roman Empire where there was one emperor and he called the shots and it was that. It's going to be brittle. And even now, as you read the news and you read about the EU, it's unstable, and there's shifting and there's nudging and there's, you know, they're figuring the whole thing out. But at some point, you're saying, wait a minute, you said there was 15 or 12 or whatever it is. Right. But when it finally takes the form of the 10-toe iron and clay thing, there'll be 10. Because all you got to do is watch. I mean, they are merging, and countries come in and countries go out. And it'll be nothing to turn it into 10 countries. That'll be no problem. There'll be a couple countries come in and maybe a few merging together and maybe a couple out. But when it's all said and done, in Europe, with Rome as it's based, I believe there will be this last governing world power. And you might say, well, that's ridiculous. Yeah, that's what the Babylonians said. And that's what the Medo-Persians said. And that's what Greece said. Oh, whatever. They'll never come. Who are they? And we say, who's Europe? Well, I'll tell you what. Europe is rebuilding and reviving. And the old Roman Empire, even right now, is beginning to gel and coagulate, if you would, and come together. It's not what it's going to be. But we see are you tracking with me? We see the beginnings already. Not the beginnings, but we see the tail endings, I think, of this 10-nation confederation of iron that is having its roots in the old Roman Empire, but clay, because it's mixed together with diplomatic ways, it's not going to stand. Now, what's significant about that, you might ask? Well, here's the significance of all that. It says in verse 44 that in the days of those kings, that the king will come and establish his kingdom. All that to say is, in the days of those 10 kings, the King of Kings, Jesus Christ, is coming back. Amen? You see, we've been living in this age of grace, known as the dispensation of grace, or this church age that we're living in. When Israel rejected the Lord and God turned really to the Gentiles and he opened up the door for us to come into the family, that day is going to end with an event known as what? The rapture of the church. That's when Jesus comes, but he doesn't come back to the earth at that point. 1 Thessalonians 4 tells us he comes in the sky, and we meet him in the clouds. And then there's that 7-year period of tribulation that we're studying currently on our Thursday night study. And at the end of that 7 years, what happens? Jesus Christ comes back physically. We come with him, and he touches down on earth and sets up a literal, real kingdom for 1,000 years here on earth. It's called the millennial kingdom. And it says in the days of those 10 kings, that's when the King of Kings is coming back. So here's the way I'm thinking. He's coming back when? After the 7-year tribulation, right? And that's when those 10 kings will be set up. But here's what I'm thinking. We already see it happening right now. We see it happening before our very eyes. Undoubtedly. It's not a coincidence that Israel became a nation in 1948 and then boom, in 1948, Europe began to unite once again. It's not a coincidence that there's a one world or one European economic system at work. It's all fitting in. It's all little pieces of the puzzle. And there's coming a day when all 10 of those toes will be in place. And I don't see that day as being too far off. The great thing is that how many years is there between the rapture and the second coming of Jesus Christ? 7-year tribulation. So I'm thinking, if we already see the 10 toes coming into play, that means the rapture of the church is really, really close. I believe Jesus Christ could come back at any moment. And you're saying, Jason, why did we take a whole Sunday morning to just read through Daniel 2 and to get, that's your point that we're close to the rapture? Yeah. Kind of. That's my point. But also this, keep in mind, I take the time, even at risk of maybe being redundant for a lot of people or confusing some people or whatever, I take the time to go through Daniel 2 because I know what's ahead in our study in Revelation. I know where we're in chapter 11 and 12 and 13, and we got so part of my motivation, I confess this morning, is education. I want us to be sinking our roots down and just flat understanding what the Bible's talking about, because these things will need to be in place. They're going to come into play later in our study of the book of Revelation. So part of my whole agenda this morning was to just teach us, to go over, to remind us of these prophecies in Daniel, but also to motivate us. Because man, this stuff is going to happen. Pinpoint accuracy. We look at these scriptures in Daniel, these prophecies that at the time they were scratching their head saying what, and we look back now as history and say, man, boom, just as Daniel said they would happen. In fact, so accurate is Daniel that there's been attempts since the book of Daniel was written to discredit Daniel for writing Daniel, saying there's no possible way that Daniel could have written Daniel because the prophecies are too accurate. Somebody must have come in after the fact and written these things, and which is silly. It just means that God knows what he's talking about. And these things are happening right before our very eyes. What does that mean? It means Jesus Christ is coming back soon. Now, one more thing and I'll be done. In chapter 7, we see the same vision. Kind of. You see, this vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, this dream, is of succession of Gentile world powers until the return of Jesus Christ. Now, Daniel also receives a vision from the Lord, straight from God, and it's the parallel to Daniel chapter 2, but this time it's not a beautiful image made out of precious stones and precious metals. This time, God gives the vision to Daniel from God's perspective. You see, from man's perspective, we look at man's governing body as being beautiful. But God says, let me show you what I think of man governing himself. And he gives the vision to Daniel, but it's not some beautiful guy with gold and silver and brass. It's wild beasts that are bloody and ravenous and all the rest. And he uses different beasts to represent those world powers. And that's what's happening in Daniel chapter 7. But at the end of Daniel 7, it goes into Daniel 8, which is expounding on parts of Daniel chapter 7. At the end of chapter 8, turn with me there to the end of chapter 8, which is expounding on Daniel 7, which is a parallel vision of Daniel 2, if you're tracking with me. There's a little phrase there, because you might say, well, Jason, this is great. You know, maybe I can know how to read my newspaper a little bit better now and kind of eyeball the EU and see what's going on there and all the rest. But what is this? How does this apply to me today? I mean, what kind of applications is there for me today? And And I like this in verse 27 of chapter 8. And I, Daniel, fainted, and I was sick for certain days. And afterwards I rose up, and I did the king's business. And I was astonished at the vision, but nobody understood it. Just before that, the angel tells Daniel, Daniel, seal up these visions that I gave you because they're not for you and they're not for your age. They're for later on. They're for us, by the way. We can look back at these visions that Daniel had and we know exactly what they're talking about. But Daniel, can you imagine poor Daniel? So emotionally drained, so completely overwhelmed by what he saw. He's actually sick for a few days. And it says after a few days, he got up. He says afterwards, I rose up. I did the king's business. And it says, I was astonished at the vision. Nobody understood it. I like that because I know for some of you, you're saying, oh, that's astonishing. Wow, that's really interesting stuff. And some of you are going, what? What in the world are you talking about? You know, and you have no clue. And this last hour, you're scratching your head saying, what's this idiot talking about? You know, what 10 kings, toes and clay and what? And you don't get it. That's okay. The bottom line is the Lord's returning soon. But what I like about this verse is let's do what Daniel did. See, he didn't understand the visions completely. And I'm not sitting up here saying that I understand every aspect of Bible prophecy. I don't. I can use the word to interpret the word, and there are some really clear conclusions that we can come to. But this one thing we can all do, whether you're astonished like Daniel or like the people that Daniel told the vision to, saying, I don't get it. Wherever you're at, we can all do what Daniel did. What's that? He got up and he went about the king's business. I love that. It doesn't say he got up and he went out into a field and he waited for the UFO to come and take him home. Or he got up and he quit his job and he maxed out his credit cards. Or he got up and he, you know, it says he got up and he basically went to work. And so what we get to do, you sit in a study like this and you go, and I don't know about you, maybe I'm the only one, but I read Daniel 2 again, and I'm familiar with Daniel 2, and I read it and I go, whoa, this stuff's really happening. This stuff's really unfolding. The Lord is really, truly coming. It's not just a myth. It's not just a fairy tale. His return is imminent. Wow, this is astonishing. And I need to do what Daniel did. What did Daniel do? He got up and he did the king's business. See, he attended to the king's business. That was his job. He went up, I like this, he got up and he went to work. And so you hear a study like this, I hear a study like this, and guess what we get to do? Get up, go to work tomorrow, and go back to your house with your kids. What do we do then? Be about the king's business. See, I like that phrase. Daniel just went about the king's business, and guys, that's what we get to do. We don't know when Jesus is coming back. I'll never sit up here and say Jesus is coming on this day because I'd be wrong. We don't know when he's coming. But we can look at the prophecies and we can compare it to current events and we can say, this I do know, it's really soon. So what should that cause us to do? To be about the king's business. Let's get up. No, really, right now, let's all stand up. Let's get up like Daniel. Rise up. And today, and tomorrow, be about the king's business. What does that mean? The king of kings, Jesus Christ. Let's be about his business. What's his business? Let's be sharing the good news, living for him. There's a lost world out there that's going to be sucked into this world system that's unfolding in front of us. And if they don't know Jesus, they're going to miss it. We have a lot to do. We don't know when he's coming back, but I love that bumper sticker. Jesus is coming, so look busy. I pray that we are busy for the kingdom of God. Listen, be about the king's business. I love to do studies like this. I love to remind us that the Lord is returning because I don't know about you, but it reminds me that's what life's all about. This life's all about eternity. When you get a glimpse, like this morning, perhaps a reminder that, you know what? Jesus is coming back, and this is all about heaven. This is all about eternal stuff. All of a sudden, the things that we're so worried about here on earth become a lot less important. And see, I have found that when I'm not focused on the Lord's return, that he could come at any moment, I have a tendency to not be about the king's business, but to be about Jason's business. Now, we all have things in life. We all have jobs and toys and families and hobbies and stuff. And those things aren't necessarily wrong. But what I found in my own heart is that when I lose sight of the fact that Jesus is coming back, I get way too wrapped up in my business. What I want to do and what I need to do and my home and my boat and my cars and my stuff and my things and my hobbies. And sometimes I just need to go, whoa, wait a minute. All that stuff's passing away. The important thing here is, Lord, I want to be about your business. Like that steward in Luke 12. Jesus said, man, happy are you when the Lord comes and he finds you just being faithful. But man, that evil steward who says in his heart, the Lord just delays his coming. And that evil steward who says, the Lord, he's delaying. He starts to get involved in carnality and beating his men servants and drinking and partying and just getting his focus wrong. So that's my heart. The Lord's return is near. So like Daniel, even though you might say, well, that's astonishing, or you might say, I don't get it. Get this, without a shadow of a doubt, it could be today that Jesus breaks through the clouds and calls us home to be with him. So may we be about the king's business, whatever that means. When you go home today and your family at work tomorrow, at school, guys, school's coming again. Don't go to school to learn. Go to school to be an... No, I'm just kidding. Go to school to learn. But go to school and be an ambassador for Jesus, man. Be about his business on the campus. The Lord's return is near. Like Daniel, let's rise up and be about his business. Amen? Father, help us not to lose sight of the reality of heaven, because, Lord, when we do that, we forget and we get kind of inward. So as a church... And as individuals, Lord, may we be about your business. May heaven be on our minds. And may the things that we do